Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The right wing in El Salvador and the elite realized that in order to try to privatize things, they had to use other language. They knew they weren't going to be able to just pass privatization as privatization.
On this week's show, we speak to CISPES about the ongoing struggle in El Salvador with the new right-wing government and how international solidarity is needed to push against these regressive reforms. Stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I'm delighted to be joined by Yesenia Portillo. She's a Salvadorian born in the U.S. Thank you for joining us, Yesenia.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your work with CISPES, can you explain to our audience what is CISPES and why is this work important?
Yes, so CISPES was founded in 1980, and since then it has worked to uplift the demands of the Salvadorans that are working for a dignified life in El Salvador. And at the time when it was founded, the main thing that it was working around was demanding that the U.S. government stop funding the military dictatorship and stop supporting the military during the Civil War at that time. And since then has all continued to put pressure on the U.S. government to stop intervening militarily, politically, and economically in El Salvador.
Most people who are not familiar with Latin American history perhaps do not realize that there has been over 100, you know, U.S. invasions in Latin America. And El Salvador, as you know, it's a very tiny country. However, has been a very important geopolitical area for the United States. Can we talk a little bit about the significance of the end of a military dictatorship regime that happened for more than 80 years? The Salvadorian people were governed by military dictatorships. And then in 2009, we saw the election of the FMLN. What kinds of, perhaps policies, improvements, did this new government signal for the people of El Salvador?
Yeah, so 2009 marks actually the first time in El Salvador's history where there is a progressive, truly progressive government in El Salvador. Before that, the war ended in 1992. That's when the peace accords were signed. And so from that point forward until 2009, there was a period of neoliberalism where about 32 national industries were privatized by the right-wing government that was in power after the peace accords were signed. So the peace accords were somewhat of a counter-revolutionary thing where they were able to move forward with these neoliberal reforms that continued to enrich the elite. So in 2009, when the FMLN came into the executive, there was definitely a reprieve from that push for plundering, basically, of the resources of the country. The FMLN was able to put a brake on this pushing forward of privatization. They definitely were able to put a brake on that and implement programs that were better, that were social reforms that were beneficial to the most marginalized communities. One of the major achievements that happened under the FMLN was the passage of the anti-mining law. And that law in and of itself is something that has, the social movements struggled for, over a decade to get that passed. But it was definitely about saving the country's water resources as well.
Now, the world may remember that the Salvadorian people had been taken to court by Pacific Rim for this law. And after 7 years of fighting, the Salvadorian people were actually won that challenge against Pacific Rim, which was an odious $277 million lawsuit for preventing them from polluting the water. Can we talk a little bit about what that victory has signified, not only in terms of what that means as a as a victory that is, unprecedented in the world courts, but also in terms of the level of pollution that has been eliminated from the Salvadorian water?
Yeah, well, the reason why local communities in El Salvador started to organize themselves against this threat that mining posed to the water resources in El Salvador was because at the time when exploration was happening, they were already seeing the impacts of that on their rivers. So at the local levels, communities started organizing and fighting back. The independent media in El Salvador, the radio stations, really started sounding the alarm about what this threat was to make it, really put it on the national scale. And so the reason why Pacific Rim was kind of able to bring a lawsuit against the government of El Salvador for prohibiting them from exploitation was because of CAFTA. The Central American Free Trade Agreement is something that was signed during the previous right-wing administration that really gave corporations the upper hand and said, national governments are not allowed to inhibit the profit-making possibilities of corporations like this. The case was being heard in international courts, and like you said, the amount of money that El Salvador would have had to pay had they lost this lawsuit would have been just devastating for the people of El Salvador. But fortunately, the international courts ruled against Pacific Rim because they were a Canadian mining company, and they tried to have a subsidy in Nevada and try to say that they were covered under CAFTA, but really they weren't able to prove that they even had standing. And so that was one of the elements. But additionally from that, in addition from being able to overcome that devastating lawsuit, the Salvadoran people were also able to push their government to pass an anti-mining ban, a national anti-metallic mining ban. And that's the first and only at this point national metallic mining ban in the world. So it's really extraordinary that the social movements were able to achieve this, and also is a testament to the commitment that the FMLN had and has to protecting the environment.
Most of us familiar with the history in Latin America know that neoliberalism was something that came by force and has led a significant bloodshed history, beginning in Chile, and it has spread throughout Latin America and is now the new reality. And for many people, neoliberalism is just a name, but for us, it means the privatization of very integral structures. For instance, in El Salvador, communication, the dollarization, which has meant that El Salvador has shifted from its own currency, the colon, to the dollar. What are the impact of this processes of privatization and of having other banks, for instance, becoming privatized?
Basically, the impact is that the state is no longer able to properly provide for the people because, for example, with the banks. When the national banks were privatized in El Salvador, the state lost a major source of revenue that was helping fund, for example, schools and healthcare in rural areas. And so that, that's just one thing, one example. But right now, for example, the big struggle that the social movements are pushing against is the privatization of water. And this is also something that the right wing has taken up, that they've been pushing for since, the early 2000s, that once it was clear to the people that privatization signifies increased costs for basic things that they need. In the early 2000s, people were taking to the streets in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands in El Salvador to push back against efforts to privatize the healthcare system. The protection of the healthcare system against privatization was one of the first major victories that the social movement had during this period that had brought year after year after year of plundering of state resources and the resources of the people. So in 2003, when they were able to save the healthcare system from being privatized, that kind of marked the end of that period of just straight privatization. Like even before, the International Development Bank was pressuring El Salvador to privatize its water. And so, of course, this is like a matter of life or death. This is a vital resource, so it wasn't something that was going to be easy. So after the healthcare privatization wasn't successful, the right wing in El Salvador and the elite realized that in order to try to privatize things, they had to use other language. They knew they weren't going to be able to just pass privatization as privatization. So the IDB worked with the Salvadoran elite to kind of figure out a plan, an alternative way of presenting the privatization of water that would be more palatable for the people. So in 2006, Don Isaka was presenting they called it decentralization at that time, which would make it go from a nationally controlled water system water management at the local level that would still rely on concessioning out services at the local level. So ultimately, it would still lead to privatization. And at that time, the social movements were still clear that that's what it was, even though the government was calling it by another name. And they still said no to the privatization of water at that time. But the reality of El Salvador is that the water is like de facto privatized because there is no law, there's no national law that actually guarantees the right to water for Salvadorans. So anyone that has the money to access water is able to. And so what that ends up looking like is corporations overusing the water, contaminating the water without any kind of real regulation.
Why mobilization? Because people are not just mobilizing for the right to have water. They're mobilizing for the right to consider that this is a human right, that, mm-hmm. you know, we can live without food for a number of days, but we really can't survive without clean water. You know, we really need water to survive. Let's talk a little bit about the movements on the ground and how is this being made possible? What kinds of attacks are they facing at the local level?
So like you mentioned, this is it's a stark reality for folks. So in the rural areas, 25% of the population has no access to potable water. So people in El Salvador really know what this looks like. They know that their water is in danger. I think about 90% of the surface water is contaminated. So even though it rains a lot in El Salvador, because of, you know, just maybe like centuries of deforestation, the drinking water is largely under threat. Even though there is this scarcity, the way that the reality is set up right now, corporations use up most of it. So 52% of the water is in use by the sugarcane and meat industry, and the bottling industry as well uses up a majority of the water. And all of that water that's being used up is for profit making of the sugarcane bottling industry that actually exports all of those goods. So none of that is actually beneficial to the people of El Salvador. And so this is why since 2006, the social movements have been pushing for a general water law that would, you know, guarantee everyone's equitable access to water, that recognizes that water is a human right, and that it recognizes that it should be protected from profit-making entities. as well as that there's like regulation from the contamination. So it would also protect the little water that El Salvador currently has from ongoing contamination. So there has been kind of a push since like at least 2007, 2006, when the social movement consulted, researched, and put forth a water law that would do all of these things that the people so much need. And the right wing, once again, in 2012, began to present their own version of a general water law that, in effect, would lead to privatization. So they were proposing a water law that would, the decision-making body would be made up of a large number of profit-driven entities. And so the social movements knew that's what that meant as well at that time. And so they pushed back against it then. So since that time, it's kind of been stuck. But in 2018, when the right wing gained a lot of seats in the legislative assembly, they actually had a super majority, which means they can pretty much pass through anything they want. They pushed forward their own version, that privatization version of the law. It became clear that that's what they were going to be working off of, and that that was that they were going to just push forward with privatization. And that's what led to so many people taking to the streets in the summer of 2018 to denounce that.
El Salvador has a new president. President Nayib Bukele was elected in February 2019 and inaugurated in June 1st, 2019. And it's been only 100 days or, you know, take or give a few days there, over 100 days since he was elected, inaugurated. And already we are seeing several threats to public unions. Can you talk about why these attacks seem so pointed at labor movements in the country?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, back in the early 2000s, one of the major unions that was able to defend the healthcare system from privatization, a major player in that activism, was the Union of the Social Security Institute, which provides healthcare to a majority of Salvadoran workers. And so they have, you know, some of the most well-organized sectors of society are these unions. So they've just been an important mechanism of defense against privatization generally. And when it comes to water, they also mobilize. And so, you know, once the water privatization was being pushed in 2006, 2007, they were also an important part of pushing back against the privatization of water. And also again, in 2018, this most recent attack from the Legislative Assembly that was trying to push through this new kind of privatization law. It really is the public labor unions that are able to pull the masses to take to the streets around even this issue of water, because this is something that affects everyone. So the attack on the SDIS, which is, again, the union for the Social Security Institute, is really dangerous. And what's happened is that the labor minister has legitimized a coup of the leadership of that union. So there's a minority group of people that basically has taken over control of the union.
When we think about Latin America, we are very familiar with IMF loans and the practice of restructuring, which usually means privatized essential services and mm-hmm. that make people more insecure and cause a lot of harm to the public health of the population. We've seen massive riots and rallies across the region in Chile, you know, in Uruguay. We've seen what impact this you know, every infrastructure can take. Now, when we look at the new president, El Salvador, we're seeing an open door to U.S. ambassadors and to U.S. influence in how the policies are being made. What concerns you about this open door policy with U.S. and the new government of El Salvador?
Yeah, I mean, it is really concerning. The first speech that he gave after he became the president of El Salvador was at the Heritage Foundation here in Washington, D.C., which is an ultra-right-wing think tank that created basically Reagan-era policies that chose a lot of the cabinet picks for the Trump administration. And he went there and promised all of these xenophobic business people there that he was going to end all migration from El Salvador, and that El Salvador was now open for business. And what he's being kind of lauded for and I guess awarded for is his security plans, which are not anything really new, unfortunately, from the right wing era to even through the FMLN, unfortunately, was also pressured to take on a lot of these kinds of security policies that are based on punitive responses rather than addressing the root causes of crime and violence, which are, you know, in mass inequality, right? And so he is really pushing forward with these same kinds of security policies that have failed for four decades now, at least, that the U.S. imposes on El Salvador, and so he's being kind of is able to cozy up with the Trump administration because he's so welcoming and openly welcome to these anti-immigrant, anti-poverty, like anti-poor policies that are really just going to criminalize the most marginalized people in society.
How can people learn more about CISPA's work and perhaps how to join forces with the people of El Salvador in protecting not only their water, but their right to having streets that are not militarized, you know, and that are constantly aggressing poor people, having rights to health, having rights to, you know, to employment and to a life with dignity?
Yes, definitely. I think tomorrow actually is the Day of the Unionist in El Salvador, and CISPAS is going to be launching an action that people can take online. It's basically a letter to the labor minister of the Bukele administration demanding that they respond to the demands of the labor movement, that they stop the attacks on the cities, and that they pass the general water law, and that they protect the rights of workers as the labor movement is demanding. So you can find that tomorrow at the CISPES website. It's CISPES.org, and CISPES is the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. And then we also have Facebook pages. We have different chapters across the nation, and our local chapters also have their own Facebook pages and their own Instagram pages. So you can always kind of follow those things for content and for actions and for just staying aware of what's happening in El Salvador and the way in which, you know, the U.S. and El Salvador, the U.S. elite and the Salvadoran elite are kind of colluding with each other to really continue to exploit the Salvadoran resources.
Now, there's a lot to be concerned about, you know, with Trump's policies, with the new move to the right-wing government in El Salvador. What inspires you? What keeps you feeling hopeful and energized to keep going?
So definitely there's a lot to be angry and concerned and worried about. I think one example, you know, the National TPS Alliance here in the United States has been taking the lead from those directly impacted by Trump's xenophobic racist policies to across the board, and an important protection that about 400,000 people from many different countries have had access to, which is the temporary protected status. And recently, the Trump administration and the Naib administration have come to some agreements, and it's being touted as though Naib has actually achieved something for Salvadoran TPS holders, and as if he alone has been able to achieve this. But really, the National TPS Alliance has been organizing in the United States to create a permanent residency for all of these families. And the only thing that Bukele was able to supposedly get is an extra year for Salvadorans to repatriate once their status ends. And in exchange for that, he entered into a bunch of security and surveillance and agreements that give biometric data of Salvadorans to the United States, different things that we don't even really have all of the details about, but that are really dangerous for our safety and for our own personal rights. It's really an infringement of people's rights. So just the fact that these attacks are continuing and that people are continuing to organize against them is really important, I think, and keeps me going, as well as the reality that I have a large community of diaspora in the United States. So the Salvadoran, because of the mass exodus that happened due to U.S. intervention, the Salvadoran community is really a transnational one. And so connecting with fellow Salvadoran diaspora in the United States that knows that, you know, we know our history, we know why we're here, we know why our families were forced to come here, and we know that those things continue to today, is kind of what pushes me as well, making those connections with my community, how we can continue to raise awareness amongst ourselves so that we can empower ourselves to be there for each other and for our families back home.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us today. Give us your website once more so people can be in touch with CISPES.
Yes, it's cispes.org.
Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.